Welcome to Education Suspended, a podcast focused on exploring, engaging, and dialoguing with those in education who are passionate about changing the status quo and evolving the archaic system we have inherited.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Education Suspended. Jessica Pfeiffer here. I'm actually recording this during spring break, so I hope those of you that get to have a spring break take some time for you. I have to keep this intro kind of short because the Iowa State women's basketball game is starting and I have to go watch it. But just because it's a short intro doesn't mean this is not going to be an amazing episode. So in our episode for this week, we sit down with Christine Kaur-Kira, who is an assistant professor at the University of Nebraska. Long story short, I met her through her cousin who works in a school district in Phoenix, Arizona, where I was working and training, and I was talking about Education Suspended, and she goes, hey, you need to meet my cousin, Christine, and talked about the work that she did. And I am so grateful that she did tell us about Christine because her work is wonderful. We talk about all things doing with wonder and the importance of wandering and why they're connected. And it was a joyful conversation. And even since then, I've been trying to be more intentional on getting outside for myself as an adult to wander in nature, knowing how vitally important it is for me holistically and as a practitioner. So Christine, thank you for joining us, everybody. I hope you love this episode as much as we loved meeting with her. And please, when you're done, go outside and wander around a little bit. All right, everybody, sit back and enjoy Education Suspended with Christine Kaur-Kira.
Have a great day at school. Stay kind and curious.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Chris. Let's hop into the reason that you're here and the reason that you're giving us your time. I'm going to hand it off to you, and I'm going to have you say essentially just hello to our listeners. Talk about what you do, how you got to this place in life, the cliff notes, essentially. And then our favorite part, talk about your own experience as a student, your own experience in school, growing up, and what connections does it have to now? And then from there, we'll see where we wander off to.
All right. Well, thank you so much for having me here to talk with you today. I've listened to your podcast many episodes now, and I'm really appreciating all the cool conversations you have and the work that you're doing. So my name is Chris Kira, and I currently am an assistant professor of practice at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln in early childhood and education. So that means I teach child development and human development courses and mostly work with pre-service teachers. In a lot of ways, anyone might have guessed when I was a preschooler myself that I was going to become a teacher. I grew up on a farm and my whole family was full of teachers. My mom was a teacher. My dad was an elementary school principal. And I have lots of aunts and uncles who are in education. And my husband is an educational psychologist now. But when I was little, probably my favorite thing to do besides playing outside was playing school. I even kept a grade book on my brother and sister so I could tell you what they didn't do well in. Obviously, listening and following directions was high on the list, but I'm not so into grades now as I was back then. And so when I got my first degree, it was in elementary education and early childhood, and I started out teaching early childhood special education students in public school settings, and then moved to a private school called Dimensions Education Foundation, where we had a pretty good size for our community early childhood program. And I was a toddler teacher there. So part of the great joy in that was working with the same children and families from when they were 18 months until 5 years old. So I got to know a lot of children and families well then. The other thing I did before I even got a teaching degree was camp counselor and outdoor education. So tried to combine my two things that I loved whenever I could. Once I had my own class of children, I was noticing that families weren't playing a lot outside in nature when they weren't at school. So we did a good job in our program of getting kids outside a lot, but the families were not spending so much time outside. And some of them were saying, well, we don't know what to do. We don't know where to go. So we started a little family nature club and met at different parks around town. At the same time I was doing that, the organization I worked with started becoming interested in outdoor classrooms. We started helping other schools build nature-based outdoor spaces. We intentionally called them outdoor classrooms instead of playgrounds so that teachers could see and families could see that you can learn as much or more outside as you do inside. And the more I worked with teachers in workshops and things like that, the more I was like, you know what? If I could get these people when they're before they've started or when they're first entering their career and help them see how much joy they could have in their work if they spent more time in nature and the possibilities they could have if they understood that having a teaching degree could mean a whole host of different kinds of jobs or roles they could take on. That's when the unexpected part came out of after about 30 years of teaching and administering early childhood programs, I joined the University of Nebraska in teacher education.
I'm really loving where this is going. Yeah. I don't care if we spend the whole time just talking about nature and education. I mean, I would love it. So I'm going to shut up, but I'm going to jump back in. I'll guarantee you because I love the direction, Chris. Thank you.
Before we pivot there, I want to spend a few moments. So I love the lens of child development. Steve loves the lens of child development. I think for both of us in our professional career, it's one that, and I don't want to speak for you, Grainer, but that we are exposed to a little bit later in our professions, right? Like I remember learning about the brain and a lot more that I wish I had known as a young clinician in the educational world. And so I think one of the things that stands out to me as I became more aware of child development and kind of the trajectory that it is, what stood out is that it's not abnormal that we have these gaps. You know, our educational system has for all stakes and purposes a very linear developmental expectation, a trajectory that we expect kids to have. And I feel like the kids that we struggle the most with don't meet that linear trajectory for whatever reason. And so I'm wondering, do you see that? Is that something that you're aware of? And I think for me, it's when this kind of gap between their chronological development and versus their developmental functioning. The older these kids get, the worse we do at serving their needs. And we forget that skill acquisition happens in a sequence, which we can see when they're little. But when these big bodies have the little people skills, we forget this.
So glad you said that. And what first thing that pops in my mind is, and you're probably familiar with him, Sir Ken Robinson, who's a great TED Talk speaker. And one of the things I really enjoy that he says is that we treat children as though they're cartons of milk with an expiration date. And once they enter school, they're grouped with others the same expiration date. And that's the way we teach them. And so I think that's probably actually what drew me to early childhood is that I saw the opportunities for flexibility, mixed age grouping, and, you know, just a more holistic approach, emergent kind of following children's interests as an integral part of education. That certainly it's possible to do that as children get older, but it's just not the norm. It's just not a part of what the way we tend to set up our systems. To allow, not really, I shouldn't even say allow just for their developmental learning. We should strive for that, right? We should support that. And everyone has different strengths and needs throughout our lifetimes. And so if we could work in developmentally appropriate ways with all students, we would see that one child's strength and one child's challenge makes them the perfect partners as we're helping them.
This trajectory that we're expecting kids to have, when they don't have it, we don't know what to do. Like we don't know how to scaffold the skills that exist outside of the academic world. So we teach teachers the zone of proximal development, right? How do you work on one side and the other side of the curve for the kids that don't fit in that bubble, right? And scaffold that. But when it's a social deficit, when it's an emotional or behavioral deficit, that capacity, we teach them how to differentiate from an academic perspective, but I just wish that we could do the same thing from a social and emotional behavior perspective, which I think actually we're going to move into that now, but I think nature gives us the opportunity to do that.
Absolutely. And also one of the cool things I'm seeing now as a teacher educator is that Lillian Katz talks about congruence between how we teach teachers and how we want teachers to teach children. We can do the same thing in college classrooms, right? I love that. If I try and continually ask students, what are your goals? Where are you at? What do you know about this? And have them share their expertise, then they're so motivated and see how affirming it is. I'm like, of course, that's the way I want to be with children. It's the way we should be with each other all the time.
I'm jumping in with a cart and a horse question for Chris, because I loved when I read about you, just what you just talked about in your university classes now, especially in the ones that are rather large, you create little communities, which I loved. I don't know what came first. You learned that with your preschool kids and brought it to the university, and now you're, you know, playing it back the other direction. I just would love to know a little bit more about how you created that and what you learned from it.
Yeah, well, cool. That is, it's a large human development, a large section human development course, which is generally 150 students. And I wish I could say I learned to do small groups when I taught preschool and I brought that with me to the university. But actually, I have great colleagues here and learned it from one of the other professors in my department. That was a technique she used. She calls them families rather than communities. But for me, communities make sense. But it is the same principles. It is everything we do, everything we learn is in relationship. And you can't study human development or child development without working with other people, right? It doesn't make sense to just read it in a text. We can learn from each other. So that's the idea around these small communities, is that we learn about each other, about each other's cultures and experiences and our own understandings of those experiences. I never imagined myself teaching 150 college kids in a classroom when I had 3 and 4 year olds for years, but it's one of the things that makes the class much smaller for them and much smaller for me. So I can get around and talk with them in small groups too.
Jessica, I think it leads right back to your chat about differentiation, which is really hard for teachers to do if they're trying to sort of parse it out in some mechanical way. But when you get nature involved and when you get community involved, it seemed like differentiation happens all by itself. Has that been your experience?
I would say yes, it certainly supports it. But I also think differentiation sort of carries with it some connotations of didactic instruction. It's sort of like, yes, here's what we're all going to be doing. And I can vary a little bit based on your individual needs or where you're at, but we're still all going to the same place and we're all going to be there by Wednesday, you know? So I know that's not really what it is, but that's just sort of how it can feel to me. So in the early childhood curriculum courses, we do a lot of talking about an emergent curriculum. And one of the beautiful things that we found, both in the research that I used to be a part of in Dimensions and what my students observe, when children are playing in nature-rich spaces and they are playing rather than having a lesson taught to them outdoors, there's the, you know, opportunities for them to explore bugs and plant a garden and experience the rain. I mean, it can be anything. But when they get to choose what they do, then we as adults, teachers, have the opportunity to watch them closely and see where the misunderstandings and where the excitement lies, and then jump in with some zone of that proximal development, some scaffolding, some new information if that's where they're at, or some great provocative question to see if we can untangle what they're thinking about. So I don't know if that's truly answering your question, but I do think nature can be an equalizer in that way. And actually, this is a bit of a bird walk from where we are, but one of the things I think is really important is not all teachers are comfortable in nature to start out with, or see the opportunities. They might see it as a time for a break rather than a time for learning. But in my experience with teachers and supporting them, once you can kind of get over the hump and experience some of the cool awe and wonder yourself by spending some time exploring a tree or planting a garden, then we often see that it can help you feel really effective in your work. It's a big stress release for adults to be outside regularly. And when you're in that better place, right, then you can be more engaged, more in tune with the children, and actually feel like, oh my gosh, I can be a good teacher out here. You know, I can ask the right questions, or I can help children see what they've discovered.
I'm glad that you brought up the adults, because I think one of the things that seems to resonate with you that you're really interested in is this sense of wonder, this reality that as little baby humans, we're born with this innate desire to wonder. It's this, you know, Steve and I talk about in the context of curiosity, right? Like we all have that. And yet to be able to access that, to be curious, to be in a sense that you can wonder about something is also a privilege, right? We also acknowledge that. And at the same time, I think when I think about the adults, it seems like as we develop in our current educational system, that sense of curiosity, that sense of wonder is actually begins to diminish. It begins to go away. Connect the dots for us. I get it. Steve gets it. But really, what's the power behind nature and play that actually brings that back, which in my opinion, brings back another strong entity of learning, of being engaged as a student?
Yeah, well, I think there's some evolutionary roots there, right? That there's some core knowledge that we're sort of meant to have and understanding the world around us as part of that. And so, like you're saying, children tend to be drawn to this. Like, that's why it's so hard to walk with the toddler. They're stopping at every crack in the sidewalk, or they're, you know, for adults who have an agenda and think this is where we're going. I feel like that's a great analogy, actually, is that what we need to do, the adults need to do, is slow down and pause at the crack in the sidewalk with the children. So I think children are drawn, all humans are drawn to understand the world around them. And then when we give children and ourselves the time, the space, and the materials that nature provides, sort of the scientific inquiry model plays out over and over and over and over again. So if we want to get more children involved in STEM, we want to get them excited in the STEM fields, let's have them outside experimenting, and they can decide what the experiment is, what their hypothesis is. And we can be the ones documenting it. We can be putting it on paper and helping them sort of construct the process or reconstruct the process after they have done it hands-on. So I mentioned materials. So open-ended natural materials like sand and dirt and slices of wood, I like to call tree cookies, can be the best things for children to explore because they're doing all the thinking then. They're the ones deciding what it is and how to use it. And when you have to have those kind of sensory-rich experiences in order to continue to fuel that sense of wonder and curiosity, the more you figure out about the world, the more you realize you don't know. And so I think we lose that as we get older when, for children, it's when they're put in situations where we treat them as though we're pouring the knowledge in their head rather than it needs to go through their hands to their heart, to their head. You know, they really need that sensory rich time to explore, for them to care about exploring, and then also for them to want to crave the knowledge, the information that helps them make sense of what they've just discovered.
You are a professor at a university and you get this, but in a lot of ways, while it's so important for the students, we have to begin to reteach that skill to the teachers.
You're so right. And one of the cool things that happened as we started, so I mentioned it's Dimensions, and Nature Explorer was the nonprofit program of creating these natural outdoor classrooms. One of the cool things is that teachers begin like thanking their principals and thanking us when we're out there helping them create these spaces. Like, I can finally breathe again. I can see the child that I struggle with, the student that I struggle with in the classroom is actually doing these really cool things out here. And they're the strongest ones. So everyone else wants them in their group to be able to move some of these things around or build this fort or whatever. And so, yeah, I think when we give teachers the opportunities to see what's possible, again, we don't have to do as much. I'll tell you about the research study that says why that's so. I love to talk at you about all my stories, about my experiences with children. But really, all you have to do is be out there and really watch, let go enough that you can see what's happening, and you're hooked right away. You're there saying, of course, I can see that this works. Now, it doesn't mean that changes the whole system, but I think we need to reach it right top down and bottom up. Because we have so many teachers who are in the classroom who have great instincts and actually have had great training in how to work with especially young children, but all students, but the system isn't set up to necessarily help them continue to draw upon what they know. What I do is, I've heard you use the term unlearning with my college students. I have to try and be super overt about it. At first, they just thought I was disorganized or maybe didn't know enough, because I'd be like, will you tell me, why do you think we should do this? Or I would say, here's five things we might do today, and let's decide together what we're going to do. And it can look like I didn't know what I was doing, or I had to tell them, but I'm intentionally doing this because I want you to see students need to have the buy-in and the engagement. And I want you to have that buy-in and engagement with your education too.
I'm guessing all three of us might describe ourselves as developmentalists. And I just wonder, what's the magic in teacher education of understanding that sensory processing is the beginning of learning? It has to be bottom up. It has to start there. We process everything, you know, basically through our brainstem. But teachers we don't typically get taught that. But maybe you can help us a little bit with the sensory part that really makes the foundation there for not only to teach us, say, yeah, I might want to try it, but maybe I really should.
Yeah. Well, a couple of things come to mind. One is that, you know, we think about our hierarchy of needs, and you can't get to handwriting if you're falling off your chair, or you can't get to that higher level thinking if you're feeling dysregulated. And so it's sort of counterintuitive. Having an avalanche of sensory experiences, like being outside in the rain, playing in the snow, having your hand in the soil, all of those things actually do help children regulate and get a sense of equilibrium. So that helps all of us be in a better, more ready place to learn. So I think that's one way that we can help everyone recognize. So without giving away too much about my age, there wasn't a lot of brain science when I was in school. We just didn't know a lot about what way children's brains were developing. So it wasn't until later that it was new to me to understand how close, you know, the parts of the brain are for the memory and sensory experiences. So I smell a pine tree and I'm immediately in my favorite forest in Colorado. But that's true with many of our memories. If we have another scent related to it, or a texture, or the way the lighting is, we can actually recall facts and more information more clearly when we've had some sort of a tactile or another sensory experience coinciding with when we first learned it.
And kind of not a reversal, but in thinking of it the other way, when that isn't in place, it's impossible to teach.
Right.
You just can't get there.
Yeah, John Medina has a book called Brain Rules. He talks about, if you wanted to create a space that would made it the most challenging to learn, you would put the most children in a classroom. You'd put students in a classroom. The classrooms we create with all this visual stimuli everywhere, and yet nothing tactile appropriate, nothing natural, no natural light. We have to close the shades because that would be distracting to children if we let the natural light in. You know, all those things are just not the way humans are meant to be. And it's too disconnected.
I'm glad that you brought that up, but it is, again, sometimes I joke that I sound like I'm Alanis Morissette writing her song, Ironic, but it is just so bizarre that this is where the plane has landed, and that we're just stuck in this cycle that makes no sense.
I would say some cool, hopeful things are that with the terrible pandemic we went through, a lot of people realized they needed to be outside. It was the safest place for them to be, and began to see the benefits of spending time outside, both themselves and that when they were with children, as schools began to reopen and have children back, there were a lot more people, teachers taking children outside. And then, of course, everywhere we saw the childcare crisis and people realizing how important childcare providers and teachers were in order to keep the economy running and keep parents at work and all of that kind of thing. So I hope that we'll be able to keep some of those important takeaways with us as we're moving forward.
I think I read that a number of your students really appreciated one thing about you, is that the projects you did, they were able to take into the real classroom. I would love to hear an example or two. And I'm speaking on behalf of my fellow middle school teachers or high school teachers who think, yeah, they go, oh yeah, preschool. Of course they go outside. Of course they put their hands in the dirt. Of course they do that. But I teach at a high school. I'm guessing you've given some examples and some project possibilities where you say, no, there are ways. Maybe a couple examples.
One of the best parent-teacher conferences I had was with a high school teacher who told me that my daughter was the best tree climber. And this was her English teacher. So unbeknownst to me, because at this age, she's telling me she wants to go to the mall and I'm dying inside. And yet her English teacher in high school said, oh no, we go outside and read once a week. And she's up in the tree as high as she can get with her book. So you can do anything, almost anything you're doing inside, you can do outside, and you will at least have some tangible peripheral benefits of a light wind that calms people down, or the sunshine on your face that kind of boosts your mood. I think I might have said something about David Sobel earlier, but he has a book, The Geography of Childhood. And one of the cool projects that he writes about in that book is having students build a history of the place where they are. You know, it could be the place of the school or something else in their place. So that can be understanding the natural geography there, but the historical, who lived on this land before us, who else has made their home on this land. And that could be insects or birds or plants. This could be a history project or a science project or an English project. When I was doing workshops with teachers, this was a middle school teacher told me that having their children write, their students write poetry outside was a game changer, because all they had to do was watch the ant walking around on the branch and they had a poem versus coming up with some big idea on their own. One other thing I would say is that I know that you both are promoters of collaboration. And so doing group projects, doing them outside can be a great way of building those sort of soft skills of understanding how to share your perspective and learn from someone else. So, you know, PE classes outside, anything that you do outside that requires students to work together and gather resources to, you know, work on their project and those kinds of things can work well when at least part of it's done outdoors.
I appreciate that a lot. I was that English teacher who said, like, how can I write nature poetry in a classroom? Well, that just didn't even make sense. I also taught the parts of speech outside, because you could go discover the parts of speech. They hated that inside, but they were definitely okay with it outside. I just think it's imagination of the teachers is the only thing limiting. Don't let that limit you. There are so many ways to bring that. And going back to something Jessica said a long time ago, is it's the teacher who benefits the most. I did it very selfishly. I'll just admit it, because I wanted to go outside. And I don't think that's any more a selfish reason to get out and get that regulation. And I think the relational part of it that goes, that you just mentioned.
Right. And a lot of people think, because I like to talk about nature, that I'm anti-technology, but some of the coolest projects I did with children involved technology. So again, this would work with older students, but having students make field guides of different places that you visit, they can use photography or plant identification apps or insect identification apps, all those kinds of things on a project like that. I worked with another woman who brought in, we called it a snake camera, but it was a plumber's tool that they put in pipes with a lit camera on the end. Preschool children were loving creating their stories as they could reach up high into a bird's nest and, you know, actually see the baby birds and tell the story about that, or put it through the dirt and see what was happening. You know, there's sound mixing apps that children can record sounds in nature and create their own music or compilations from. So yeah, I hope that that's something else tangible that people would consider.
These are great ideas. And at the same time, to reflect on kind of what you've said already today, is it's okay just to let them be too, right? Like giving agency to these older students of like, I wonder what ideas you have. How could we take this outside? I think that they would actually have some really interesting things to say.
And it can make the rest of the work on the project or whatever it is they come up with fly. Because if it's their idea and they've got to have some say in how they go about it, you can still have the same goals and objectives, but how you do it can be different if you involve them in those initial processes.
I think, Chris, the other thing that I really appreciate about you and your work that aligns very much with this podcast and where Grainer and I come from is just not that we don't love the kids, but we love the teachers, right? The continual necessity to not overlook our educators and to ensure that they are cared for, right? That they have the support that they need, and that at the end of the day, the care that we provide them is only the care that they're going to be able to give to our students, right? Like if we're not caring for them, they can't care for our kids. And so one of these quotes that you gave me that I really liked was by Ruth Wilson. And I was just wondering if you could unpack it a little bit for me, because it's so simple. And yet I've read it numerous times. I'm like, no, this is actually, there's a lot to unpack here. And so this quote that you gave us from Ruth Wilson says, "We don't have to choose education or enchantment. We can choose both." And I'm wondering, why does that resonate with you so much? And can you, yeah, just give us a little bit of your insight on that?
Yeah, Ruth Wilson is just an incredible writer. And the word enchantment just speaks to me. I mean, that really is, if we're preparing children for careers we can't even imagine yet, right? Supposedly we're preparing them. But we want to work with young people as though they're always going to, you know, with the things they're always going to need to have to help them fill up on all the joy and wonder in the world. So they carry that with them. That's going to serve them well in everything they do. And yet there is that, I think this is a roadblock, actually. There's that constant pull and tug with, yes, that would be great if we could go out and play, but I have this, we're preparing for this standardized test and my job's riding on that. I can't do both. But what I like about what Ruth Wilson says is we actually can do both. What we need is the skill set of the teacher to both recognize the value of that time outside, but have the skill set to be able to pull out children's experiences and document them or explain them in a way and help children then link them to what they're learning in the classroom or build on that with what's happening in the classroom. We really can't have one without the other. You can't keep yourself from learning if you're outside and enchanted with the world. You're going to learn in spite of yourself almost. And so again, when you use that as the hook to link it to what you talk about inside in the classroom, or to help children see that maybe a cycle they saw in nature is a cycle they can see repeated in something mechanical or in another area, then we really can have both. And it also doesn't mean when children are playing outside that the adult is sit back and not involved. It takes a caring adult who knows how to scaffold, who knows how to ask those questions, who sees the value in what children are doing and can spread that message to their parents, to administrators, to policymakers, to all those other people who need to know it too, that what children are doing is important work.
And isn't it fascinating that we learn it all from the world of early childhood?
Yes. Yeah. That old thing, everything I needed to know, I learned in kindergarten or something like that. I also, I guess, would just encourage us to continue thinking that we're not actually ever preparing, see our job as teachers is to prepare students for the next thing. That's one of my strong memories from my own education, is being told you can do that in elementary school, but in middle school, that's not going to fly. Or yes, I'll help you in high school, but in college, your professor isn't going to be available to you. Well, that's not true, but it's also not really what we want. We don't ever want to be seeing, it's not fulfilling for me to think that my job is only to prepare children for the next thing. It's to help them be the best they can be in the moment and help them be empowered in their own education.
And I'd agree with Ruth, it starts with awe.
Yeah. And we shouldn't be afraid of talking about children's social emotional development as spiritual development. It really is. We all have a spirit within us, and enchantment comes when we nurture our own spirit.
The whole human, the whole being.
Mm-hmm. Well, another quote, if you don't mind, that's really important to me is a Rachel Carson one.
Can I take a second? Absolutely.
Okay. If a child's to keep alive his inborn sense of wonder, he needs the companionship of at least one adult who can share it, rediscovering with him the joy, excitement, and mystery of the world we live in. So I think that's also why children and teachers are near and dear to me, is it takes both.
Oh, Chris, thank you.
Well, I have loved having time to talk with you and appreciate your questions and your good thinking and examples that you both share too.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to this interview and sitting down with you. I mean, not just because of all the ways that you are changing the game of education, but just because, again, your passions lie so closely to Grainers and I, and it's inspiring. It's puts me in awe. So thank you.
Yeah, really hopeful.
Great. Yeah. Well, I have great colleagues and great mentors. I always have. So I think that's what also inspires me as a teacher, right? Is that having had all the great teachers I've had.
Yeah, it's a good reminder just to think back to the ones that you loved and stuck with you. And there's a lot there. Well, again, Chris, thank you. Thank you for the awe. Thank you for the inspiration today. I'll do my best to link your website through the university to our website so people can check out all the amazing things that you do and just learn more about you. But I know you're busy and it means a lot that you gave us your time today.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Luce, the Lindbergh High School senior intern who edited today's episode. Education Suspended is a production of Intricate Roots and Educational Consulting Services. Our producer is Jessica Pfeiffer. Our Education Suspended website was created by Grainer Media. Our production manager is Gina Henson. Music is provided by Spastic Pinky.